I was so nervous doing this podcast because I knew you were going to ask me like self-exploratory questions. And I was like, oh, but what if they find out that I'm a nutcase?
Hello, you're listening to Truthbook with me, Catherine Smith, a mum and clinical psychologist. I am on a mission to get us more connected, sharing real stories about family life. You will let out a sigh of relief knowing it's not just you, be empowered by other people's words, and share a giggle at the funnier side of family life. And on today's episode with Rosie Gildethorpe, mum, clinical psychologist and podcaster, we chat the ups and downs of not being able to multitask, her experience of severe pregnancy sickness and impact on mental health, how we can break down barriers to seeking therapy, and we have a giggle at the image Rosie has of herself in one of her parent moments when you were glad no one else was watching. So Rosie, welcome to Truthbook. It's brilliant to have you on. I asked you to come on because you're also a mum and a clinical psychologist and a podcaster. So we're both with our headphones, we're all set up. And I'm also inspired by your vision in setting up the Psychology Business School and Do More Than Therapy, which is about trying to help private psychologists help others as much as they can. And you've also, the way that you market yourself is very refreshing as a consumer. I find your emails and Facebook posts and podcasts really engaging. And you also specialise in mental health support for pregnancy, birth and parenthood, having had your own experience of a crushing 9 months of pregnancy sickness. And I know we're going to come and talk about that at some point in this podcast. But you do all this alongside being mum of three and a military spouse. So your husband can sometimes be away. I'd like to dip into a little bit behind the scenes on how you juggle this. What keeps you going when it gets really stressful?
Oh, what a question. So firstly, I'm really happy to be here. It's not often that I get to be a guest on a podcast, so it all feels a bit different for me, but it's a nice experience. And it was nice for me actually to reflect a little bit on this kind of question, because it does sound like a lot, doesn't it? Like when you were just describing it then, I thought, gosh, that sounds really tiring. But I think one thing that really helps with the juggle is actually that I don't really juggle stuff. I can't multitask. I don't multitask ever. I only do one thing at a time, which it's been hard over the last sort of 6 years-ish of running a business to learn how much I can do in a day. But now I know the limitations of that. I think what's really helpful is I just say, right, I'm going to do these three things today, and they can't be done on top of each other. So I just kind of focus on a few things rather than ever trying to say, look after my kids and do work. Those two things can't be done together for me. My brain won't allow it. So yeah, so I think that's actually how I juggle it. I never really feel like I'm doing all of those things at once.
Wow. So I should have checked in with you at the beginning. How old are your kids?
Yeah, so my eldest is six, and then I've got a 4.5-year-old and a 14-month-old.
Wow. How do you not multitask with such young kids and manage to focus? Is that a skill that you've developed?
I don't think it is a skill, actually. I recorded a podcast episode ages ago where I got really honest about this, because I think my brain is possibly not neurotypical.
Okay.
Because I have always done this, and it used to cause big problems, and it does cause big problems actually, because if you're not multitasking, then when you're engrossed in something, or when I'm engrossed in something, I will completely forget about everything else. Oh. So I'm recording this with you now. I'm not thinking about my to-do list. I'm not thinking about appointments or, you know, anything else. I'm just in the moment, which is wonderful for therapy, isn't it? I mean, that's exactly what we want in the therapy room. But if you're like that with everything, then you find that, well, I found anyway, since becoming a mum, I'll forget stuff, like when I need to go and pick the kids up. I'll forget to get the right stuff in for tea. I forget about, you know, kids' birthday parties and, you know, all of that admin that we take responsibility for, especially when I'm solo parenting, because as you mentioned, my husband's not around that much. So I've kind of had to build my business around the way that my brain works and get the support in the right places to make sure that that doesn't trip me up. So, you know, something that I learned really early on was I can't be responsible for my own scheduling, because that's something which I can't hold all the information in my head, because I'm talking to the client. I can't also be thinking about, you know, when am I free and when am I not free? So I'd end up making loads of mistakes. So I now have the lovely Anna, my wonderful VA. She handles all of that for me. And I rarely, rarely, rarely get involved because I mess it up. And that's a big stress reliever for me. Yeah, the other thing, it's just another type of support really, but I have my 3 days a week of childcare. And I don't try and do work outside of those times. I mean, don't get me wrong, if the baby's napping, then yes, I'm a bit of a workaholic. So I will log on and I will be doing stuff, particularly for Psychology Business School. That's the kind of stuff which I might do, you know, when the baby's napping or when the kids are at gymnastics on a Saturday morning. I do that kind of thing then, but I don't have to. I never have critical tasks that have to be done on those days because the baby might not nap. Or I might have, you know, a kid who's too poorly to go to gymnastics. So I really only schedule stuff to be done in my 3 days where I'm working. And I theme those days. So Monday is Psychology Business School day. Wednesday is paperwork day. I will generally not do anything on a Wednesday that can't be done in a coffee shop is my rule, because I'm an introvert and I need to kind of honor that day of silence, which is nice. And then Thursdays are my clinical day, and I'll do everything on a Thursday which relates in some way to my clinical practice. So I see my clients typically in the morning, and then in the afternoon I'll be working on my pro bono projects, stuff I'm doing with the charities that I'm working with, things like this podcast interview.
Wow, have you got a color-coded diary? Is it?
Yeah.
Yes.
It really helps. I couldn't cope without it, yeah, actually.
We're quite different. It's mine's all over the place a bit. And I'd look at colleagues with the color-coded diaries and be very envious.
But it's about how your brain works. I wouldn't do that if I didn't have to do it.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, it sounds like you're very accepting now, or that's how my brain works, and this is the positive side of it, although there's also the other side. So what was it like when you were figuring this out? What was that like?
Really painful. Especially, I was kind of okay when I was working in the NHS. I think people thought I was a bit odd, maybe, because I've always been somebody that would do my working hours and then leave. Because I'm like, well, I leave at 5.
Yeah.
And I've always had lots of stuff going on. I suppose that's also part of my character, that I would always be like running a marathon, or there'd always be something that I was working on outside of work. So, but I always held that boundary quite firm. But that's because when I was at work, I was in flow state the whole time. So when I was with my clients, I was 100% present with my clients. When I was writing a report, I was 100% writing a report. I didn't do very much office chat. Unless, because I like people, I would occasionally, I would literally make a little diary entry for myself to be like, just chill out for half an hour and have a chat with Laura, that really nice girl that sits next to you. So I would occasionally, but really the level of focus when I was at work, I think made me seem a little bit strange sometimes, maybe. But it would mean that I would always leave at 5, but I would never get behind. Stuff would be done. And I think people would often be envious maybe of that, or think that they envied that, but actually it's a really exhausting way to live your life when you never get distracted. I don't remember to eat, drink, look after myself. If I haven't got reminders being like, get up from your desk, walk around, take a drink, go to the toilet.
Wow.
And I don't know, I mean, I've never been any other way, but I don't think it's really something to be envied. I think we should just all respect strengths and weaknesses of how we are, because yeah, the other thing is I have to exercise, and that's, it's non-negotiable, because you wouldn't want to be, you know, I'm in exercise gear now. This is because I had my morning clinic, and you would not want to be talking to me now if I, you know, just sat still all day, because you would find my brain popping off all over the place, and I'd find it difficult to make my point in a way that made sense. So that's something I kind of need to do. And again, people are like, oh, it's so virtuous, but not really, it's not how it feels. It's much more kind of, yeah, about managing, really. And so when I got into private practice, I hadn't really done that reflection because I'd gotten away with it in the NHS, I think. And I hadn't really realised that I needed to take proactive steps to keep all the plates spinning. And so I did some really amazing work. I'm proud of the stuff I did when I first set up. I wrote a massive amount of content very quickly, and I got my marketing going really quickly. And because I guess I was 100% focused, because in that early stage of setup, I didn't have clients, but I basically built a business which tortured me. You know, I was forcing myself to do stuff which felt awful, you know, doing all the admin, all the scheduling. I just beat myself up constantly for every mistake I made. And there were so many, you know, all of my invoices would be wrong. I don't even know how I made the mistake. I'm not a details person, I suppose, but I think, and we could pontificate for hours about the social pressures that make women think they should be. But I really thought I should be able to do all of my own admin. So every time I made a mistake, I thought, had all these really negative narratives about not being cut out to run a business, not being clever enough to do basic maths, just yes. And so many scheduling errors. And then the guilt for, you know, maybe forgetting. I never forgot to pick my daughter up from nursery. I always knew that had to be a reminder, but I might forget to like get the food in that we needed and stuff, because I'd get very excited and immersed in these projects. And with my husband not being around in those early days, I just felt like I was sort of losing on all fronts and being rubbish in all of my roles, because I wasn't really giving myself permission to set the boundaries that I needed. Yeah, it was hard in summary.
Got a very good understanding of yourself, and that is something that I think is to be proud of. You're saying people might think you're being really virtuous going for exercise every day, but actually it's something I think to be proud of is you've got that understanding. I'm just wondering and thinking about a lot of the young people I work with who are at that stage where they're at school and they're like, I just think differently to other people. I'd love to ask you, what was it like at school?
At primary school was really bad. At primary school, I'm very wonky. I'm very good at what I'm good at, and I suck at what I suck at. And there was no understanding that that was possible when I was at primary school. I remember teachers constantly calling me lazy, telling me I wasn't trying when I knew that I was, and just really feeling very ashamed of the stuff which I wasn't very good at. I can't really learn stuff by rote very well. And that was still the main model for learning stuff like times tables. I went to a very old fashioned school. I mean, I assure you it was the 90s, not the 1890s. But yeah, some of my experiences at primary school were extremely negative, and I think did have a bit of an impact on my self-esteem growing up. When I got to secondary school, my secondary school was rubbish, to be frank. It was very, very hands-off. So I guess nobody was shaming me because nobody was particularly interested, but I don't feel that I reached my potential in a lot of subjects because I wasn't encouraged really to investigate why I couldn't do it. So for example, they thought that I was bad at science, and I'm actually really interested in research. I don't feel as an adult like I'm bad at science. Do have a doctorate, I suppose, which helps with that. But I never would have believed I was capable of that when I was leaving school, because I had this narrative of not being good at it, when actually our science classes, the discipline in the classroom was very poor. So the noise of the other kids, lots of chatting, I couldn't focus on the teacher because there was so much else going on. And as a kid, sometimes it's more prudent, isn't it, to focus on the social interactions. I've got a very pragmatic brain, and it will focus on the thing which is going to help me the most. And that often didn't, maybe it made the decision that that wasn't the lesson, that was some class politics that was going on. And so when I look back, I can really understand why I didn't do well in the subjects I didn't do well at. Maths, I just don't have a working memory for numbers, which is weird, but I can't hold numbers in my mind at all. And a lot of it is mental arithmetic at that age. But again, I didn't have any of that self-awareness at that time. It just felt like I was bad at all these things. But at least I had the subjects I was always good at. So I was always good at writing. always good at English and had an affinity when we got to A levels. I took psychology against advice. They told me it was a science and I shouldn't do it, but I kind of just knew I'd be interested enough to be good at psychology. I mean, what does that even mean? But I was hyper interested in it as a subject. And as anybody who, you know, maybe has this kind of flow state experience knows, if you're hyper, hyper interested in something, it just goes in no problem. And so we had terrible teaching for most of psychology. We didn't have a teacher half the time. Then we had a teacher just read the textbook to us. Often she wasn't a psychologist, I should say. She was a non-subject matter teacher. So she literally was just reading the textbook. And often she would like misconstrue things, but because I was so intensely interested in it, I managed to remember what I needed to remember to do all right at the exam. So yeah, I don't know. And I think socially it was tricky as well, because when you present to somebody who gets into this kind of flow state and is very, very interested in certain things, that makes you a geek. And then you can't really be friends with the geeks when you're not good at certain things. You can't be a geek in bottom set for maths. So that was tricky. So it took me a while to find my feet, but I did find that by sixth form, some of the stuff I was good at became desirable. You know, people, it was getting to the point where people did envy somebody that was disciplined enough to go to the gym every day, even if I felt that was non-negotiable. And I was also quite good at, you know, drama and stuff like that, which had been seen as very geeky. And then for some reason, when I was in sixth form, people found that to be more socially desirable. So I kind of found my feet as I got a bit older, but it definitely wasn't easy as a whole.
Yeah. And what would you like to say to your younger self now, looking at where you're at now? What would you say to your younger self in primary school?
Basically that it's that adults don't always know what they're talking about. I think it would be, you know, hold feedback lighter, because every adult that gave me their opinion on my personality, I just took it on board. You know, I think kids do. You just soak it up like a sponge, like, oh, okay, they think I'm lazy. Maybe I am, I must be. Whereas I think now if somebody gives me negative feedback, because of all the therapy and all the coaching that I've done, I am much more likely to go, oh, okay, I can see how you reached that conclusion, but equally there's another interpretation to this, and I don't believe either is true. I know, I don't really believe much is true these days. But yeah, I think if I could communicate that in some way that a child would understand, that's what I would tell my younger self.
It sounds like you've found a good place work-wise to use your strengths and that use that flow, and you've worked ways around it. You've got a PA. As a mum, it would be lovely to have a PA as a mum.
Oh yes, wouldn't it? Well, flow state is a beautiful thing when you've got children.
Yes, I was wondering.
And
that.
Yeah. I recently, we're all quite sensory as well. Me and my children, we're all very tactile. I think my husband thinks it's crazy, but we are all like this. So I recently bought a big fluffy rug for the middle of our living room, and if I'm on the rug with the kids playing a game, I can be completely immersed in that. I'm totally just with them in that moment, which is so much fun. And it's so much fun when you can do that. I think as a mum, you're very rarely allowed that, because there's so much to do all the time, isn't there? But, you know, you're right. We don't have PAs as parents. And, you know, because during the week, I'm always a solo parent. My husband comes back at weekends and then he'll do long stints abroad. So most of the time I have to take up that family PA role, because even if my husband's coming back at the weekend, he's kind of coming back and going, great, what's going on this weekend? He's not got that kind of share of the cognitive load. He doesn't know when the clubs are, what uniforms they have to wear, or yeesh. I mean, I can't even remember it all now because I don't multitask. So yeah, I've had to develop systems for that, much like the business, but I can't really get the support in the same way. So it's all about lists and using the project management software Asana that I use for the business. I also use for home life.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it's just acceptance that if I try and hold it in my head, I'll always be stressed and I'll probably miss things. So I don't really try and hold much in my head. I get it all written down, all out of my head. And then I just kind of follow what's on the list for the day. it takes a bit of discipline, and I sometimes fail. Like when the baby's not sleeping, just like everybody else, I'll wake up when the alarm goes off, not when I intend to wake up, and I'll kind of be behind and I'll forget things. And I won't have written the list that needs to be there for the morning because the night before was such a nightmare, and that happens. But I think I've developed over the years an acceptance of why that happens, and a genuine compassion for the fact that, I'm a mum, I feel sick with tiredness. If I don't get 8 hours sleep, I feel sick. And I don't think I've had 8 hours sleep for years. So I always feel a bit residually rubbish in my body. So if stuff falls off my radar, I kind of forgive myself for it a lot easier than I used to. And partly that's because of the clinical work. I think I was reflecting on this with somebody else earlier this morning, but one of the real privileges of being a psychologist, especially in the perinatal space, is that every time I help someone else to forgive themselves and to hold that compassion for their self, I think it gets stronger in me, the ability to do it. I really, that insight into other people helps you, I think.
I would echo that, and I think it is a real privilege of our work, and it's exciting talking to someone who can say I've acknowledged, I've accepted these stresses, and I give myself some compassion, a hug, and
Yeah, and just permission to be a bit rubbish sometimes. I mean, because if I wrote down everything that was going on at the moment, I would be amazed that, if things weren't going wrong. And so, yeah, I mean, often we don't make it to the playgroups I want to take my youngest to. That it doesn't feel great, and I do get lots of self-critical thoughts about it, but I think going back to that kind of, okay, I'm feeling really rubbish right now, I'm just going to breathe, or maybe I'm going to try and do something nice for myself, even if it doesn't feel like the right thing. I'm just going to make myself a cup of tea, give myself a minute to breathe, and just, allow that feeling to be there and know that it will probably pass. And it does, it does. And I'm having to practice that an awful lot at the moment, and I think every time you practice it, it does get stronger. It's practicing what we preach, I suppose. Yeah, it gets me through.
I wonder if you came to develop such acceptance and compassion, not just through training, but from having to learn to cope under very stressful circumstances when you experienced severe pregnancy sickness, which I think has driven your passion for working in this space.
Yeah, it's weird. So that first pregnancy, I suffered with severe sickness. And some people might know that as hyperemesis gravidarum. That's the technical language for it. I prefer to call it severe pregnancy sickness because the criteria for what constitutes HG has changed. So when I was pregnant with my first, I would have definitely met that criteria, but I totally convinced myself that I didn't. And I think there'll be a lot of people listening to this who know exactly what that feels like when you invalidate yourself to the point where you don't get any help because you just don't think that you deserve it. And I was in such a bad mental space that I couldn't, I there wasn't a part of me that could pull me out of that. And so I don't like using that language in case there's somebody listening who then thinks, oh, well, I don't have it that bad. I don't deserve the support. Yes, you do. Like, if you feel so sick that you can't do anything in your life that brings you fulfillment, you deserve some help. Like, I wish that every person suffering with sickness would hear that, if your life feels meaningless because you're too sick to do stuff, that's not normal. That's not what other people experience in pregnancy, because I needed to hear that message and I didn't hear it at all. In that first pregnancy, I never heard anything to contradict my inner narrative that I just wasn't coping with something that was normal. It isn't. I mean, what does normal even mean?
This probably applies to lots of things, that if you say how bad it is, you feel like you're complaining and you might not be heard, which would be awful. So, but then if you don't say how bad it is, so that you're not avoid complaining and avoid being invalidated, you have to suffer.
I think the reality is, and I went to a very interesting conference about this with pregnancy sickness support in the autumn. And, you know, most people, when they come forward for support, they are not heard. They are not heard. They are told it's normal. And if you look at the NHS guidance, it is the most invalidating thing I've ever had the displeasure to read. It tells women, or people, it tells people to take ginger. There's no evidence base that ginger helps with any kind of nausea, let alone the kind of severe debilitating nausea that these people are looking for help with. Because you can guarantee if a pregnant person is coming forward for support, because of all our cultural narratives around it, it is definitely bad enough to constitute help. Whereas most medics seem to immediately put this wall up that says, you know, I am going to test this person to check that it really is bad enough to be worthy of help. And that is odd. And I found it really weird because most of the people at this conference were medics who were very motivated to change that narrative. And so I was asking, you know, why do you feel that colleagues might have this impression that, you know, maybe people are attention seeking or just not coping with something that is normal? And the only way that any of us could make sense of it was that they don't feel that they've got anywhere to send them. So it's their helplessness. They feel, you know, they want to be the rescuer, but they've got nothing to offer. That was all we could kind of arrive at, because, you know, for all of us in that room, it was a bit mystifying why anybody would recommend ginger when you've got somebody maybe in tears in your consulting room saying, I can't go on like this. Or, you know, even maybe I'm thinking of aborting this pregnancy because I can't go on like this. It's a very common experience. It's very difficult to be referred to the next stage of help.
But there's something even just validating about, even though there might not be the help, that they need to have it validated and to have it labelled, so that that self-critical or that I'm complaining is heard.
Yes, but also it's... Just, you know, if there's any, there might be somebody listening to this who needs to know about it, but Pregnancy Sickness Support, the charity, have got really clear guidelines for any kind of GP or professional who might be thinking, I don't know where to send these people. There are services. There's medications that you can try in primary care. There are first line and second line medications that can be given in primary care. But beyond that, there are specialist services where you can refer these people for more intensive support. And all of that is detailed on the Pregnancy Sickness Support website, including lots of helpful tables and things that medical people will love.
I'll put links to all of this in the show notes.
Thank you. Yeah. And I've also got some guidelines that I created for where you can send people for mental health support, because that's the other thing that I think needs to be recognised, that if you are dealing with severe sickness, your mental health will suffer. It's unavoidable, because we know what constitutes good mental health, and that includes meaningful activity, meaningful relationships, being able to do stuff that means something to you in the world. And if you're vomiting 30 times a day, you can't do any of that. So your mental health will suffer.
How did it then impact on those first few weeks, months, when your baby was born?
Well, actually, I was elated. So I was one of the lucky people who went from this kind of bone-crushing sickness, like 9 months of really anything that I put into my body tasted awful, smelled awful. Most of it came back up. And I mean, the elation of that, I think potentially what I was left with some kind of concern that maybe I wasn't cut out to be a mum. That was a thought that kept recurring on me, because I hadn't enjoyed any element of the pregnancy, and so I hadn't had any excitement leading up to the birth, because I couldn't feel anything other than nausea. Honestly, when I look back at that time, it's just grey and black, and there was nothing other than sickness. I think I put on a brave face of it. I didn't manage to go to work very often, but probably when I was there, I might have presented fairly normally. I mean, I don't know. You'd have to ask my colleagues. And I remember trying to do a couple of things with friends, and I didn't cry the whole time, but I think I got through by just cutting off, really. But really, my experience was just incredibly dark. So, yeah, after she was born, things could only have got better, and they did. They just got better really rapidly. And although I did have some kind of residual thoughts, intrusive thoughts about what the experience of the sickness might mean for my motherhood, I was sort of expecting those. I've known in my life a lot of women who have really struggled with postnatal depression. And I knew that there was a link between HG and postnatal depression. And so I was very mindful of what those thoughts meant and what they didn't mean. And I sort of expected them to go if I didn't give them too much attention, and they did. I think there is an element of knowledge being protective about postnatal depression. I think I knew not to invest too much of my time in those thoughts. And I used a bit of mindfulness. I wasn't as into it back then as I am now. I've become really into mindfulness. It's one of my kind of pillars of my practice now. But then I just was kind of experimenting with it, doing a bit of the kind of headspace stuff. And yeah, I would say that made the difference. I just didn't get sucked into that loop.
That's a fortunate position to be in, that you had a heads up that this might be coming. And I wonder, yes, would it be helpful to be more honest that pregnancy might not be this glowing, wonderful experience? Your hair might fall out and all sorts of sickness, the gums bleeding, gosh, the list could go on, and that have the negative thoughts and am I cut out again, the list could go on. And if you have a heads up, you can take a step back, but for many it can be consuming.
Yeah, I mean, It shocks me that we're not more honest about that kind of thing. I mean, I think it is difficult because obviously, you know, my children were the most wanted children. And, what I really don't want is for them to ever listen back to something that I've put out in the public arena and think, oh, you know, she hated being pregnant with me, and to feel that that means something about them. When, especially because I think it's important to talk about termination thoughts, because that is, it's such a taboo. And I think women who are struggling with severe sickness to the point where you're not keeping anything down, you're not keeping water down, it wouldn't be a human mind that didn't have that thought. I think, you know, I've had the pleasure of speaking to a lot of people who have suffered in the same way that I did. And this is the one, you know, we all cry when we talk about it, right? You know, it's catching in my throat talking about it. But I will, and I persistently will, because I think that although it feels uncomfortable, and I do worry about my kids ever hearing about that, I think it's testament to the strength of these people that they come through that experience, you know, including myself. It's the thing I'm proudest of. Enduring that first pregnancy is the thing I'm most proud of in my entire life, because I would not judge anybody for not being able to. You know, if you didn't have the support network that I had, if I hadn't had the husband that I've got, if I didn't have the economic stability, the NHS kept paying me, even though I wasn't at work. There are so many privileges that I had that enabled me to just hang on by a thread to the end of that pregnancy.
You're able to share and be very honest now and share those honest thoughts, like you said, any human would have about termination. Were you able to share them with anyone at the time? Or did you?
No.
No, because you would be so shocked.
I was horrified that I felt like that. Yeah. I had the impression, because I'm quite an active person and I was 28, we'd wanted a baby for a long time. Healthy eating was a big part of my life, less so now, more so then. I kind of thought that I would be one of those pregnant people who, you know, embodied the like strong, I'm a feminist, I wanted to be a strong woman, didn't want to be, you know, having to take a seat on the tube and that kind of thing. And really, I was the absolute opposite of that. I became like an invalid, like the opposite of the pregnant person I expected to be. There was no pregnancy yoga, none of it. I felt robbed. So yeah, nothing stacked up to my expectations of pregnancy at all. Yeah, I can't remember how I started that conversation, but yeah, it was hard.
I'm also wondering about people who have gone through this, because it's traumatic.
Yeah.
And you have been in a setup, in a context where going to get your own support was probably reasonably easy, and you know as a psychologist that it's important. So what advice would you give to people now who are maybe still traumatised?
I mean, firstly, find out with your GP what NHS services you're entitled to, because the scope of perinatal services has expanded in some areas. It's a postcode lottery, but if you're within the first year, then you can get support from your perinatal mental health service, and I'd really recommend it. Like, don't think that you have to suffer with this, or that you should just be grateful because you're healthy and your baby is now healthy and that you should forget about it and move on, because that is impossible to do. You know, I would have loved to have been able to do that, but I haven't. The scars from it are still with me, even though I've taken steps towards healing. And so I think expecting your brain to just go, oh, but we're healthy, it's okay now, that's not going to happen. It's not how we're wired. Otherwise, you know, I provide private services. I know there are lots of other people that do. Mm. We've got therapies that are really helpful. EMDR is the one that I go to support people with this. That's
eye movement.
Oh, am I going to say this right? Eye movement desensitization reprocessing.
Thank you. Yeah. You helped me out there.
Technical terms. But basically, it's a way of stimulating the brain's natural healing process so that those memories can go into your life story where they belong, rather than kind of popping in and upsetting you at odd moments when you really don't want them to. And that's particularly valuable, I think, if you're finding that, you know, memories of that time are coming back to you maybe when your child is ill. For me, nausea is an extremely triggering thing. If I get poorly or one of my kids gets poorly, I go straight back to those feelings of despair and feeling like it's never going to end. And, you know, I really lose my perspective around illness, which is why I don't really drink anymore. I would never put a hangover on myself. But yes, I can be quite avoidant of triggers around nausea. If I hadn't done a bit of work around it already, and I would definitely be continuing this journey, I wouldn't be able to take my kid into class when I knew that somebody had a sickness bug. Like, you know, there's loads that you could end up limiting your life around if you don't address it. So, you know, even if you're not having massive trouble with your triggers at the moment, trust me, parenting brings most things to the fore at some point. And so do think about getting some help. You know, it's kind of work I love doing. I've got lots of colleagues that do it as well. So you're not alone with it. There's lots of people that will understand and validate your experiences and help you to heal from them. So do come forward for help. Don't suffer.
No, and I think that what you just said there leads not just necessarily to nausea, but when you're a parent, all the other things that come out, and you have to be really struggling before you get to help.
You know, I had 3 years of therapy while I was going through training, which was the first time I'd really developed that kind of self-reflection capacity. And that was really meaningful to me. And since then, you know, I've had therapy here and there. And I also have had a lot of coaching. And I think, you know, when you set up a business, it's a real exercise in self-reflection. Like, you can screw yourself over massively if you don't know what your tendencies are, because you will throw yourself into projects that bring you nothing but pain. Trust me. And we all do it, you know, to different levels. But I found coaching in my business has often really shed light on how some of these internal processes show up in life and how I need to address those. And often the coach will direct me in really practical ways of, you know, do this, it'll make your life easier. But often the real value that I've taken from it is just somebody going, that's not the best way of doing it. Why do you think you've set it up like that? And you look back and you think, oh my God, maybe I'm punishing myself in some way. Or, you know, maybe this is because I'm ashamed of not being good at admin. Or it really kind of uncovers stuff. So I'd really recommend, if you're running your own business, get coaching alongside. I love therapy now in my other side of my life with psychology business school. I wanted to step into that role to do it for other people, because every psychologist has got hang-ups, right? We all do.
Yes. And yeah, it's not part of our training that you go, and we all have a fear that we're going to be found out. That we don't really know what we're talking about.
100%. Like, I was so nervous doing this podcast because I knew you were going to ask me like self-exploratory questions, and I was like, oh, but what if they find out that I'm a nutcase?
Isn't it? Yeah, Yeah. I think also as parents, this sense that other people have that maybe, well, you've got it all sorted. You must know exactly what to do. And, you know, I remember running parent courses here locally and then being in the supermarket and bawling or doing everything you shouldn't be with your kids and thinking, God, I hope no one can see me.
This is one of the best things. It's one of the reasons I'm quite passionate about marketing is that if you share those experiences and I share those experiences, then slowly this stigma degrades and people start to see, yeah, even people that have the privilege of tons of training and tons of insight will still not be able to be perfect parents any of the time. And so if I can, if we can get our voices out there, that is the best thing we can do, I think, to spread the word about compassion and acceptance and make this these kind of third wave CBT principles part of the fabric of our society. It is that honesty, and it's that honesty coming from people who previously might have been put up on a pedestal. We've kind of got to tear down our own pedestals.
But particularly for you, having that honesty around your experience with pregnancy sickness and what must still be quite haunting and at the time very isolating thoughts.
Absolutely.
But it's saying that these needs shared and we need to talk more openly and honestly about it.
Yeah, and it's nice, like when I get clients who come to me because they've read, you know, a blog or a podcast or seen me on social media, often that's the thing that they'll say. And it might be that their struggle isn't severe sickness. It might be that they're having struggles in the postnatal period. But they come because they know I'm not going to judge them. And that's what they say. I knew you wouldn't judge me because you've spoken about those thoughts. And when you think about, again, because we're, you know, lucky that we might have other psychologists or mental health professionals and therapists as friends, sometimes we forget that for the majority of people, they may have nobody who's ever owned up to having an intrusive thought. And so they think that they're the only person that's ever had a dark thought in their lives. And that's how powerful it can be. It can literally be experienced like a chink of light for somebody.
Rosie, as we bring your truth book to an end, I'd like to ask for your truth book confession. One of those moments where you think, oh my goodness, I hope no one saw that.
Oh, well, so I wrote down two and I wasn't sure which one I was going to say.
Yeah.
There's many. I mean, one thing I'd like to say is anybody who is a solo parent, whether they're a single parent or like me and just parenting solo some of the time, you do loads of stuff which people who are parenting in a couple or a co-parenting relationship won't do. And so whenever I hear anybody, because I hear it a lot, people being like, oh, it's so impressive you do all this on your own. I was like, yeah, don't beat yourself over the head with that, though, because I definitely do stuff that you would not find acceptable. But I think it is acceptable because it's what I have to do to survive.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, you just have to know that. You just have to know solo parenting means compromising on stuff you thought when you were pregnant you would never compromise on. But you will. So I wasn't sure which confession to share, because there are multiple. I could just choose. Excellent. I could choose about five from just this week so far alone. But I think the one which, yeah, I'm most glad that I didn't have an audience for was on, what night are we on now? So this is Thursday. So it must have been Tuesday night. I was really struggling to get the baby to sleep. She's teething. She's having a really difficult time with it. And my other two have a tendency to go absolutely manic when the baby's upset. I think it makes them nervous. You know, I have some empathy for what they might be going through. We live in a really small house, so there's no escaping the noise. My son in particular is not great with noise. So it sends them into this like frenzy, which looks a lot like them just running around, destroying things, like taking all the cushions off the sofa, they'll fill up the bath so it floods, like anything, because my attention has to be 100% on the baby because she's, you know, in distress. So anyway, we'd had one of these evenings. It was, you know, my nervous system would have been totally overreacting because the baby had been screaming in my face for hours. I just got her to sleep. I emerge. I see all the chaos around the rest of the house. I know I'm going to have to deal with it all. But by this point, it's like 10 o'clock at night. So I'm like, I've just got to get those two into bed. They've got school in the morning. You know, the consequences, I can think about those after they're in bed. Let's just get them into bed. So I'm doing my best to get them into bed. That's quite stressful. It's not easy. manage it somehow. They seem to both be in bed. So I go downstairs to try and start the cleanup. And then I hear it through the baby monitor. Boo! What has just happened? So I run up the stairs. My son has gone into my baby daughter's room and screamed boo in her face to wake her up. Now, I'd love to say that I did a mindful practice.
Oh, my God, no.
Breathing. No, I ran up the stairs and I screamed like a banshee at him, which is an awful, that's an awful thing to do for my son because he's not great with noise, as I said. That's the wrong thing. Bad strategy. Couldn't help it. Sorry. Like, I was incensed. Like, oh, absolutely saw red in that moment. The neighbours must have been able to hear. I really, really screamed. Yeah, I screamed. And then kind of manhandled him back into bed, shut their door, which is actually okay. They don't mind that. So that I could then attend to the baby again and go through the whole cycle again. Oh, but yeah, gosh. Not proud of that. Not proud of that at all.
Well, my goodness, I can't think of anyone who would not, when your son wakes up the child that you've just tried to settle. And interestingly, I sometimes ask guests what image comes to mind in those moments, and someone says screaming banshee, and you've so there we go. What would it be, screaming banshee, or what would be your image of yourself,
well, actually,
in those moments?
So over Christmas, my kids managed to dig out of Disney Plus a really old Mickey Mouse cartoon, which I remembered from my childhood.
Yeah.
And it's the one where Donald Duck decides that he wants to stay with Mickey for Christmas, but he's supposed to migrate back to somewhere sunny because ducks can't survive in the really cold temperatures where Mickey lives in the States. And so gradually over Christmas, he like loses all his feathers and he kind of turns a funny colour. And he does that classic thing where his eyes start bulging and he's just like really like angry because he's kind of having a mental breakdown. And I thought, yeah, that's me in that moment. Like as it was happening, I felt like him. But like poor disintegrating Donald, poor disintegrating Rosie. That's how I felt.
Right, I'm going to have to do a Google image search to find that. Maybe you could send it to me and we can share that.
Yeah, if I can find it, I will, because it's a horrific image.
Well, I think many parents would relate to that.
I'm sure.
Oh, Rosie, I have really enjoyed speaking to you, and I've actually, often as I do, feel very connected and compassionate towards you, particularly because you've been so honest. And that's, hopefully your words will have reached out and hopefully help some other people listening. But it's been a pleasure having you on. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, what a privilege to hear someone through her own challenges and therapy understands her wonkiness, accepts it, and is compassionate towards herself when things are tough. And how humanising was it to hear that with all that experience, knowledge, and skills, she still has her screaming banshee parenting moments. Donald Duck at Christmas, I and many parents know you well. Thank you, Rosie. And to contact Rosie or to find out more about pregnancy sickness, all the links are in the show notes. And if you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend or on social media, or maybe you know someone who'd find it reassuring to hear Rosie's story. Or even better, come on Truthbook. Your story of how you have navigated family life will inspire and become part of someone else's family survival guide.